Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday morning. Senator Bill Bradley is our guest for a chunk of the first hour of our program. He has a new book. He's such a thoughtful man and thoughtful writer. The new book is We Can All Do Better, and he has one of those lives that's just phenomenally interesting. He served in the U.S. Senate from 79 to 97. He ran for president in the year 2000. He's a former Olympic gold medalist in 1964, and of course, a professional basketball player with the New York Knicks from 67 to 77. He's written a number of books you may be familiar with: Time Present, Time Past, The New American Story, and Values of the Game, all New York Times bestsellers. A little later this hour, we will be speaking about civility in politics, if there is such a thing these days. Our guest is the Reverend Scott Anderson, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Council of Churches, and they have called on church leaders throughout the state of Wisconsin to talk about civility as we are in a very contentious recall campaign election here in Wisconsin and as we look ahead to the elections in November. All hour, you are welcome to join us. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. You can also use this talk at WPR.org or leave messages for us if you'd like on our Facebook page, and that is The Kathleen Dunn Show. Senator Bradley, thank you so much for being with us.
My pleasure to be with you, Kathleen. Thanks for having me.
I love the title of the book. I love Abraham Lincoln, Senator Bradley.
Good, I do too.
Yeah, he was an amazing man. At one point in the book, you write about hopelessness. You say a friend of yours came back from China, told you the one theme in all of her meetings was the observation the U.S. is in decline. Too many of our citizens are losing hope, you write. Hopelessness is a serious danger for a culture whose historical attitude has been optimism. But you say the way forward is clear. What's the way forward?
Well, I think we have to deal with our problems. I mean, you know, I woke up in the summer of 2011 during the debt limit debacle and looked out and saw we had two wars raging still across the other side of the world, and that the middle income in this country, middle income people, basically had stagnant income. In 2010, the median income was the same as it was in 1996. And people were actually coming up to me and asking me about, are things really hopeless? So I decided I'd write a book to try to restore some hope. And that's what I've tried to do, to remind people that we've had depressions after depressions, wars after wars, and we've always moved forward. And that our political institutions are strong enough to really, and flexible enough to allow us to deal with our problems. And I also wanted to remind people of what I see as the goodness in the American people, people in communities across this country. They're selfless and helping their neighbors. And that really should be the foundation upon which we should build the solutions. I think that the key thing to address the hopelessness is action and clarity about what we need to do. Surely the most important thing is having more people working at better incomes. We need also to deal with the deficit. We need also to have a major reform of our political institutions that at this stage are not serving us well. And we need a redirection of our foreign policy. I mean, those are the things.
As we are in one hot and heavy recall campaign, as you know, in the state of Wisconsin, where an incredible amount of money is being spent, and the same will happen in the presidential election, I've heard you talk, and you write in the book, about a constitutional amendment which would be necessary to limit the amount of money that can be spent in a political campaign. The money is just unbelievable, isn't it?
Yes, it is. It's revolting, quite frankly. And between now and November, you're going to see an orgy of money in politics that are going to be by people who aren't even in politics. They are people who simply want to influence the outcome of a particular election. And they will spend unlimited amounts of money. If possible, they'll do it anonymously. And we'll all have to deal with, you know, the poison that they'll spew into the system. This is all courtesy of the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court decided in 2010 that corporations can spend any amount of money they want in politics because corporations are really people. That was a decision made in the 1880s. and that the result is that we now have the super PACs that are spending hundreds of millions of dollars in this campaign on various elections. And to me, that means the things that the bulk of the people want getting done are not done because money distorts the process. Let me give you an example. Between 2009 and 2010, the financial sector contributed $318 million to politicians in Washington. The healthcare sector contributed $145 million, and the energy sector, $75 million. So that meant that it shouldn't be a surprise that we had watered down financial reform, that the healthcare bill didn't even have a public option, and that we didn't even get around to an energy bill, even though we are sending billions of dollars every day to autocrats on the other side of the world to finance our oil habit. The money in politics today is really creating a major disincentive. I mean, legislation is too often for some people, not for all people, and we need to deal with the issues that concern all people.
Do you see any deep interest in pockets of this country or all over this country in a constitutional amendment?
Well, right now, I think people are just in shell shock, and they will be for the next 6 months, about what money is doing to our politics, unaccountable money. I think they then begin to say, well, what can we do? And when they see the Supreme Court rulings that say you can't limit money because to do so is to limit speech, money is speech, which I think is ridiculous, but that's what the Supreme Court has said. And then they'll say, well, what can we do about it? And the answer is a constitutional amendment. The point is we've been there before when we've had flaws in our democracy. We've actually repaired them with a constitutional amendment. For example, in the 19th century, corrupt state legislatures sent corrupt U.S. senators to Washington. They were selected by the state legislatures, and they were literally on the payroll of railroads and other interests. And then the people rose up and said, enough. And they passed a constitutional amendment that said, no, U.S. senators will be elected directly by people, not by corrupt state legislatures. So we've had a historical precedent of changing things in America when they got bogged down by money. And I think this is a moment where people can do that. And people have to realize they have the power. I mean, remember, the citizens rose up. I mean, and if you take a look at the major shifts in America, whether it was the abolitionists, or whether it was the suffragists to get women the right to vote, or the civil rights revolution, or the environmental movement, all of those activities began with citizens. They didn't originate in the minds of politicians, governors, presidents, congressmen, senators. So people have the power to do this, and developing a passion because they see what's at stake for the country around the effort to get a constitutional amendment through the Congress and ratified by the states, I think is absolutely central to being able to get our politics back to deal with what most people want in this country, which is a better job at higher pay. And they want to live in a world where we're not in wars on the other side of the globe.
Let's talk one more question for me, and then we'll go to phone calls about those better jobs and higher pay. You make mention of the fact, and I'm wondering where corporate action and responsibility, what role they play in making people's lives a little easier. You note that America's corporations have $1.9 trillion. It's hard to imagine how much that is. $1.9 trillion on their balance sheets as cash and liquid assets. And you've said if 1/20th of that were used to employ people, our unemployment rate would be down to 5%.
Yeah, it's 20%. If 20% is used for, it would be down to 5%. And the point there is when you ask CEOs, well, why aren't you hiring people? They say two reasons. One is uncertainty. I don't know what the future brings. I need a rainy day fund. Mm-hmm. And the second is there's not enough demand out there. If I produce X widgets, people won't buy X widgets, so I'm not going to take that chance. And there are answers to both of those. On the uncertainty question, what we do is we have to have significant deficit reduction. But because now the issue is how do we create jobs and how do we stimulate the economy to get out of our doldrums, we don't want to cut the budget deficit in the next year or two. But we need to pass a law that will show that we will see a deficit trending down over time by dealing with taxes, by dealing with entitlements, by dealing with defense. Once we put that into effect, we then have an opportunity for a massive stimulus. And here I would say $1 trillion of high-priority national infrastructure projects, $200 billion a year. That would create 5 million jobs at good pay. So once the 5 million jobs at good pay, people would have the money to buy the widgets. Companies would see that they can sell the goods. They'd hire more people. And we would get into a virtuous spiral up as opposed to a disastrous spiral down, which is what we're really at risk of doing now.
Senator Bill Bradley is our guest. His new book is We Can All Do Better. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Pat in Chicago is our first caller. Hi, Pat.
Hi. Thank you for having the senator. He's a great guest. I wanted to point out a fear I have, and I think my fear is that there's not a conspiracy, that somehow our system has created a natural climate where the conflict has fallen into benefiting the wealth concentrators and the power concentrators so much that they instinctively give not radicals, but people who are energized on both sides, and we get so much yelling at one another that we never hear the good points from one side or another. And even if we were able to limit the money, if it was still going to both sides and the impolite on both sides rather than to the reasoned and civilized, we wouldn't really be solving the problem.
Well, I think the caller makes a good point. I think that money is, I believe, the largest problem. But the other problem is polarization. And I think there have been times in American history when political points of view were irreconcilable, right before the Civil War comes to mind. But usually issues are resolved with political combat. It's vicious, but it's bloodless. And usually one of three things happen. You either get one party eventually dominate, which is what Democrats did in 1964, for example, or you have a more or less narrow majority, which is what it was throughout the time I was in the Senate, and even now, in which it requires bipartisanship, which we had when I was in the Senate, which we don't have now, or you have the emergence of what I see as a potential third congressional party, not a national party, not a presidential like Nader and Perot, but a group of people who have very specific objectives, such as the constitutional amendment, because they recognize the money issue, such as a massive infrastructure program, or such as an effort to try to hire people immediately by giving companies that hire and don't let anybody off, don't fire anybody, support from the government for 2 years, has a very specific set of objectives. If they ran in 50 congressional districts, those are the only ones that are competitive in America because of the way we draw congressional district lines by partisan state legislatures. And then if they won 20 of those 50, the very specific agenda that were in the interest of the majority of Americans, not the fringes and what they want to see happen, but the majority of Americans, and they had 20 successes, they had 20 congresspeople, they would be at the fulcrum of power in America, and they could very well shake this system up and make trades on all kinds of votes in order to get the votes they need to do these four things that the majority of the people really need to have done, but that we can't get done now because the combination of polarization and money. They would, in effect, be shaking people up and bringing them back to their better selves, because plenty of people in the Congress know there's a kind of a game going on that's what I call the point-counterpoint game. It's become ridiculous. They just need a way to get off that and back to the center where compromise is possible and progress is possible.
So in the meantime, it strikes many people that we may be at one of those times, maybe not so dramatic as before the Civil War, but we're at one of those times where political points of view are irreconcilable. I can't remember a time in my life, which is getting pretty long now, where there hasn't been as much dissension and completely different ideas about the vision of the country. So until what you just talked about happens, what happens? Nothing? Do we muddle through what we're going through now, which is not very much? Everybody's mad at everybody else?
Well, we all live at a time where we want instant gratification. I mean, you know, we want to have it change immediately. Some of us do and some of us don't. But many people do. But democracy works deliberately. And if you're a citizen, I mean, democracy is not a vicarious experience. It depends on you. And in the internet age, there's no excuse for apathy. And so it will take a while to move this forward. And the only other hope that I would have is if somebody did run as a moderate and they were elected and they did it in a different way, then they would change the way politics work in America. But I think that's not likely. It's possible, but it's not likely. I think what is needed is for citizens to come together like the abolitionists did. It took a while to get slavery ended, like the suffragists did. It took a while to get women the right to vote, such as the civil rights workers. It took a while to have African Americans have the same shot as white people in America, such as the environmentalists did. Took a while to clean up the air and water. I mean, democracy doesn't happen overnight. I know on the evening TV, things happen overnight, and we have to get things presented like this is the crisis of the moment. But life is a little bit more, a little slower than that, a little more deliberate. And I know that when people are suffering out there, as so many Americans are trying to make ends meet, and they look around and they see the process move slower than they would like, they begin to say, well, you know, is it hopeless? And that's why I wrote the book. If people read the book so they would understand it is not hopeless. We are in control of our destiny.
Thanks, Pat, for your call. Boyd in Milwaukee is next. Hi, Boyd.
Hi, Kathleen. Hello, Senator. It's a pleasure to talk with you. I'll make this brief. A few weeks ago, I heard on another show on Wisconsin Public Radio, one person who was talking about liberalism and thought it kind of had a dirty word, he does identify himself as a liberal, said something that I thought was very profound. I think in order for things to drastically change in this country, people overall need to change their attitude toward government. He said that 17% of the people in this country, regardless of what their politics are, overall have a very negative view when it comes to government. And what's really ironic is this country was founded on a mistrust of government. Is there any way to change that?
Sure. I mean, people who want to roll back government, I ask them simply to think about their own lives. Do they fly in airplanes anywhere? Well, the Federal Aviation Administration makes sure it's safe. Do they take medicines? Well, the Federal Drug Administration makes sure they're not taking poison. Do they ride on roads? That's government. Do their kids go to public schools? That's government. Do they get Medicare and Social Security? That's government. So, I mean, the reality is that the people who want to roll back government really don't understand that government provides the foundation for economic growth in this country by making the investments that only all of us can make so that some of us can succeed in the economy. And you'd have to ask yourself, well, if there was no government, who would do all these other things? And the answer would be, unfortunately, they wouldn't get done. We'd be a poorer country for it. I think that, you know, what you see today is you see, I'm talking about citizen activism. There are two examples of citizen activism. One is the Tea Party, and the other is Occupy, but they had two totally different strategies. Tea Party had a very clear objective, which was roll back government, had a very clear strategy, influence congressional races. And in 2000, it had money from the far right. And in 2010, they won 43 seats in the United States Congress, Tea Party Republicans. And in the summer of 2011, when Barack Obama and John Boehner reached an agreement in principle on deficit reduction, and Boehner took it back to the caucus, and the Tea Party vetoed it, it brought the country to the brink of bankruptcy. But the point here is, 3 years ago, nobody even knew what the Tea Party is. That's how quickly things can change. They can change one way or another way. And there's no reason why that couldn't happen on the left or the Democratic side, as well as the right or the Tea Party side. Now, on Occupy, on the other hand, they had very clear objective, which was not a very clear objective, but they had a very they were pointing out something very important, which is income inequality in America. And they had a good slogan, we're the 99%, but they did not have a very specific objective, like roll back government. What was their objective? They didn't have it. And they chose not to get involved in electoral politics. And so they weren't a factor. You have to reach for the levers of power if you want to change America. And the levers of power are through elections. And if you don't reach for them, then you're simply not going to have an impact. And, you know, the best example of that was the 1960s, when you had Dr. Reverend Martin Luther King with a moral vision, a dream that touched millions of people, tens of millions of people in this country. And yet it took a politician, Lyndon Johnson, to know how to pull the levers of power to make Dr. King's dream permanent by putting it into law. And I think Wisconsin is, in a very difficult stage now. Wisconsin has always led in terms of innovations in democracy. And I think right now the combat is dispiriting to so many people. And who knows, if this continues, there could be the emergence of some third force. I do not think the people of Wisconsin are fundamentally different than the people of the country. I think there is a vast middle that wants to have progress and is tired of all this shouting. Now, I personally, as a Democrat, think the Tea Party and the right wing are primarily to result of this. But whatever that feeling is, we need to have people come together. Compromise is what the country's all about. Look at what Dick Lugar, he lost. He lost to the Tea Party. He was a Republican. Good, you know, very, one of the best senators I ever saw. And the guy that won said, the era of collegiality is over. The era of confrontation has begun. And his idea of success in Washington would be having Democrats agree with his views. That shows a colossal ignorance of American history. If we did not compromise, we would not have a country. We wouldn't have a constitution. We wouldn't have been able to pick up the debts of states so that we could buy Louisiana and double the size of our country. Compromise is the essence of who we are as a people. And if we lose that, then there will be the emergence of a third force that will seek to champion it. And I believe the vast majority of Americans will support that third force.
One more phone call. Dave in Wanakee. Hi.
Yes, hello. I think part of the problem is the failure of our media organizations to properly balance the information they put out. They have a tendency to balance someone who's speaking the truth with someone who's speaking something loony just because he's got a large voice. I think of things like climate change and economic issues. When was the last time on a national media that we heard anything about ALEC? I've never heard anything about ALEC on 60 Minutes.
Senator Bradley.
Yes. Well, I couldn't agree more. I think media is right at the crosshairs of the problem here. You know, the idea that there is that there's point counterpoint, That's what people see on TV all the time. They don't see people have a reasonable discussion most often. They see short answers, short slogans, a lot of emotion, and it gens up the base of the particular cable system and win its cable channel in order so they can sell more advertisements to the people they already know are going to listen because they take these extreme views. And most people look at these things and they say, wait a minute, is that the way it is in my life? Am I rewarded for shouting at my fellow worker? Never. And yet that's what politics is. And I think the media is right at the front. As you said, what the media should do is get the information, objective information, deep information, thorough information to the citizen so the citizen can decide. The media now treats citizens like they're amoeba, and they're poking the amoeba, and the amoeba moves one way or the other way based upon what they poke. That's not their role. Their role is to give us the information we need to make as citizens. Now, it's a difficult time in America for media. Changes are happening. Newspapers are changing or disappearing. Reporting is not valued. People don't invest in that. They invest in entertainment. So it has a way of trivializing our whole political process.
All right, before we say goodbye, give us hope again.
Well, the point is to remember that our history tells us we can control our own destiny. If all you can do is look at today, then you'll never get beyond today. Mm. But if you can look at tomorrow and you have a very clear idea of what you need to do, whether it's a constitutional amendment, whether it's several ways to increase income for people, then you have something to organize around and something to champion. And one of the things I write about in the book is called celebrating selflessness. We got to build on that part of America. It's not the part that's shouting at each other on TV. It's the part that reaches out a hand to help their neighbor. It's the guy who shines shoes in the Pittsburgh Children's Hospital for 46 years. And out of every tip, he put a portion of that tip into a fund to pay for poor kids' health care. And the year I interviewed him on my radio program, he put over $100,000 into that fund. That's the America that we all know is there if we look around at our neighbors. And that's the America that has to infuse our politics.
Thank you so much, Senator Bradley, for being with us and for your new book, Always a Thoughtful One. Thank you.
Thank you. We can all do better.
Senator Bill Bradley, the name of the book is We Can All Do Better. We thank him for his time today. And we are going to continue on this. Is there a middle ground? Why are we shouting at each other? What about civility? What about the idea that we're all in this together? How do we get back on that kind of track? Religious leaders from throughout Wisconsin earlier this week called on the citizens of the state to enter a season of civility in the middle of the partisan rancor of the current recall campaigns and the anticipated divisiveness of the fall election cycle. We will be speaking about the campaign with the executive director of the Wisconsin Council of Churches. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.